Mr. Dobb, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Your Honors, my name is Russ Dobb, representing Dr. Stillmeyer, who is the appellant in this case. The general concept of the case is that you have a 12-year old medical practice, and in early 2014, Dr. Stillmeyer decided to leave. He had three major practicing school owners and corporations. At that point in time, he gave a 90-day notice to leave, and the initial hearing before the district judge concluded that the articles of incorporation and the bylaws and the method of the departing shareholder leaving or having his interest redeemed from the corporation did not comply with the professional incorporation statutes of Nebraska. Essentially, those statutes are pretty clear. They say that a departing shareholder is to be redeemed forthwith when he leaves the practice. Good reason for that. And that the bylaws and mechanisms for doing that are to be clear in the bylaws. The appellees denied the existence of that. The explicit words of the articles that was originally filed as the bylaws did not comply. The judge at that time said, as one of the alleged issues in the appellant's petition, that the corporation should be judicially dissolved. Now that geared the automatic provisions of the dissolution statute, which gives the remaining shareholders a 60-day period of time to elect whether to buy. During that period, they're to agree on price and terms as well. Dr. Stillmeyer remained a shareholder there, although he's been gone for quite some time after the 90-day term. They didn't agree, but they did agree that if they couldn't agree on price, the appellees did file an election to buy. Next step was to determine what to do with price. They agreed that there would be a fair value hearing under the dissolution statute to determine the fair value of the appellant's stock. That essentially was heard in subsequent hearings. What I think we're going to say is that the case presents a intriguing smorgasbord, although it might be a small case, of valuation techniques that have to be correctly applied. They're defined. They exist in the law. They've been ruled on before. They have to be applied to the facts that exist. There's going to be three places where I'm going to suggest some incredible windfalls occur just because of clear mistakes.
Is there an issue as to whether or not this was a corporation or not?
No, the judge ruled that it remained a corporation, but just had not technically qualified as a professional corporation.
That would only have to do with limitations of liability, wouldn't it?
Well, the concept of limitations of liability, I think implicit in Senator Lukey's testimony or any of the statutes about professional corporations is it just makes sense if the patient's entitled to know who's treating them.
But thus the question is, how much is your client entitled to receive from the existing corporation?
Yes, that's when the bottom line. There's a counterclaim that's in play, and there's a question of what's owed, which is a Wage Payment Collection Act issue that's brief.
I can tell you right now, we can't see that.
Well,
maybe you can move it closer.
I can.
Help us, first of all, if you could. What is our standard of review on this?
This is an equity action, Your Honor. It's reviewed de novo, and you make an independent determination of facts. That is the very defined nature of a corporate dissolution proceeding. The key here is that the judge, in this case, ruled that he recognized in his calculations of net book value the existence of compensation that had been moved at the time of the notice of termination. There's 17 places in this record where the appellees admit that certain funds are owed to the appellant. So what happened is that the first step in the process is a reconciliation by an appellant expert of the existing value of the fixed assets, net book value, of the net value of the fixed assets. It's a mixture of a couple principles of valuation.
When you say net value, what do you mean?
Well, it's the assets less debt. It's the fair value of the assets, fixed assets less debt. So that's a good question, because the appellant in this case has three experts, two CPAs, and one significantly experienced medical equipment expert to find value. What happened is, this was the first expert. It's Exhibit 113, and it starts by saying its goal is to determine the adjusted book value, the adjusted value of the fixed assets. Assets, appraised and corrected value, booked and reconciled from the records, net book of $132 a share, or net value. What happened then is the expert proceeded to do his reconciliation. And when he did that, he found that the day that the appellant submitted his resignation, one of the appellees moved $90,000 to an escrow account in his attorney's office. His first testimony was the $90,000 was going to protect his retirement someday, and that it was a blind trust. He eventually recanted that and called it a buyout escrow fund on the tax return. That was $90,000. Then in the next 90 days, without the appellant understanding or knowing or having an agreement, because he's on the board of directors, he's only a one-third owner, but he's a board member, they proceeded to move another $122,000 into deposits away from the corporation. And those deposits were for carpet, for the future practice to look better, for an x-ray machine for the future practice to use, and for painting of the existing facility. Now, in a minute, I'm going to explain, this is not a two-man medical practice. This is a big business. It's a $2.5 million business kicking out to $800,000 a year to the three doctors. I'll get to that in a minute. But at that point in time, we have $200,000 that's been moved. Now, what you have to do is account for that. What was it? It was accumulated earnings that the practice distributes quarterly to the people. And there's no doubt about it. So the appellees admit 17 sometimes.
What do the tax returns show as to how it was treated under the tax returns?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, that's another error, because later I'll point out that the district judge said there is no record. He points out that there's significant compensation going out in bonuses and salaries to people. And he says there's no evidence in the record that there's any 1099 or W-2 compensation methods. It's there 15 times in all the exhibits. So it's just a clear mistake. It's a quick call on something that the record just absolutely just clearly refutes. But what happens is then when he enters his order, he says that I take into consideration in my determination of net value the existence of the escrow account. And what happens is two experts get up, two CPAs, and say that in order to produce the logic of net value of stock, you have to deduct assets from liabilities.
I don't have much time left. How much do you think?
$74,000, Your Honor. $74,000. Swings as an absolute windfall. Now, in that process, and this is two other issues, I'm going to jump to one quickly. The judge accepts the valuation of medical equipment. He reduces some $300,000 of depreciated assets that is in the exhibit, which the judge said was a credible exhibit. He reduces it from $72,000 testified to by a medical expert of in-place value. He reduces it to $17,000 based on the testimony of an appellant that he prepared a list of what the stuff is listed for on eBay. Not in place, not effective current sale prices in medical equipment practices, not furniture from a house. I don't believe there's a single Supreme Court case that accepts, and I cite many in other states that don't accept, hearsay testimony. That testimony was entered over an objection. So I'll jump quickly to the last point. This court will face, I'm sure, in the future, an issue that is really a fresh, new, and extremely well documented. I presented an expert witness that's qualified in the United States. There's only four men that are capable of testifying about this issue of fair value. And what that amounts to is, I believe there's a lot of cases.
Are you talking about fair value of the fixed assets or fair value of the...
Well, you have to put the three together. First, you put together
fair value of the stock, or how are you trying to value his whole interest in this?
Well, it's the three procedures. First, you appraise the fixed assets and value them, and you'd reckon. Then the next thing you do is you, and you put the fixed assets in your first set of value, and then you determine if there's any intangible assets at all of value. In other words, when this doctor left, and what the judge said was, if a doctor leaves a practice, now there is no buy-sell agreement, there's no non-compete agreement, there's no employment agreement. If he leaves the practice and patients, he takes them or they follow him and somebody stabs, there are simply no intangibles and no goodwill. Now we know we have Vetter, we know we have Howell, and we know we have one other case that specifically says that, in a very general way, everybody uses the word goodwill, but it very specifically says that whether or not there are intangibles is a significant question of evidence and fact. The appellee in this case said it started as a practice with very little volume, 7,000 patients. It built to 2,000, 20,000. The appellant said each of those files is worth $10. He then went ahead and said that there was $3.5 million of intellectual value in these files. The tax return shows intangibles. The key here is, which is a fair value determination, the key is Mr. Best is explicitly qualified on this issue. He's well published, well written. A lot of my briefs concentrates on it. I suggest the court is going to face fair value determinations in the future. This is an incredible presentation for a witness. What he has to do, he has to sort out the definition and the evidence, and then he has to discount the value of the intangibles. Now, intangibles are broken down in identifiable intangibles and unidentifiable. Unidentifiable is the traditional word goodwill.
What I think Mr. Dodd, Kelly's, you're going to have to wrap it up.
Okay, I'm going to wrap it up. The point I'm getting at is that this is an intangible, identifiable intangible case. It is a 12-year practice, $2.5 million gross business. It has incredible, in the record, which was unrefuted, intangible assets. It has computers, over $100,000 of software compliant. It has a large base. It's in a 10,000 foot square building. It's a big practice. It costs $500,000 to move there. And during the period of time, it paid off $450,000 in debt. He leaves the company, and the judge orders net of $104,000 to the guy. And it has several hundred thousand dollars of accumulated taxable earnings are still on the books. So the point is that if you merge the concept of the correct valuation of
Mr.
the fixed asset...
Mr. Goff, well over your time.
I'm sorry.
You must conclude.
What it amounts to, in bottom line, is in the second to last page of the brief, of my brief before the conclusion, I suggest to you that an independent determination of very credible evidence and testimony in this file will essentially reconcile with adjustments of clear errors to a little over $300,000 of actual value for his 130. And the last question, it's all of the cases, ask the question of, if a man leaves, and clearly this does not comply with existing law with regard to intangible good, if he leaves, do the other guys have something left? Is there something left of value? In this case, it's a huge practice. They still have it. He left and started over.
Thank you very much. Mr. Foreman, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Larry Foreman, report on behalf of the Appellees in this case. I'd like to try to take my time this morning before you and try to do two things. One, I'd like to give you an overview of everything that happened in this case that brought us to today. And I'd like to give you three good reasons why, when you're looking at the disparity in evidence in this case, you need to listen to Dr. Nagel rather than the so-called experts from the other side. Basically, these three physicians practiced together in Papillion, Nebraska for a 13-year period beginning in 2001. But when they started the operation, each of them was dedicating 4 days a week to the activities of PFM. Very soon after they began, the The appellant decided that he was going to, instead of spending 4 days a week on PFM, he was going to spend only three because he was getting more and more involved with his site activities, with Allegiant Health, and with Midlands Hospital, to the point where he was actually spending 54 hours per week on these outside activities, the exclusion of PFM. Those activities over the last 4 years of the association of these three physicians generated over $1 million to him. He kept all of it. He didn't share it with anybody. We never asked him to share it. But we think when you're looking at his fiduciary duty, he needed to be accounting for that fourth day of the week when our guys were still working for PFM and he was off doing his stuff, making his $1 million with.
Is that an economic or an equitable argument?
I think it's both, Your Honor.
Well, how do you value it?
From the standpoint of when he's off doing that stuff and not benefiting these people, then that is a definite detriment to them.
Isn't this a
violates the fiduciary duty?
Isn't this simply a claim of what my interests in the corporation are at the time I leave? Not what I should have done during the practice or what I could have done during the practice? Isn't the question, I own X number of shares of stock in the corporation, I've left, and I want the value of that stock paid to me?
The problem, Your Honor, with looking at this thing as a corporation is that it's a corporation in name only.
Well,
these three guys didn't have any idea how to run a corporation.
Well, are you going to treat it then as a partnership?
I think you can look at it as a partnership.
All right. What is the leaving partner entitled to when he leaves the partnership?
Well, I think if you look at what we've done here, because we've tried to evaluate what he did to us because of all the money he was making from the sideline stuff, treating this as a part-time job to full-time. If you also look at the fact that he was continuing to serve the Medicaid patients, and as Judge D'Astero found, that damaged our people to $230,000 over that last 4 years. He was also continually difficult because he never wanted to put any money into this operation because he wanted to maximize the money he was taking out of it. Then at the end of 2013, we found out why he didn't want to put any money into this thing. Because basically, he gave us a notice. He said, oh, by the way, guys, I'm out of here. I'm taking one-third of the staff that this company has trained. I'm taking all of my patients. I'm going to relocate a mile away in Papillion. And there's no non-compete situation here, but to do that to them and then to leave them with all the obligations for this entire leasehold space that was now going to be 40% vacant because he and one-third of the staff were gone. We think that was another example of improper conduct on his part because of the impact it had on him.
Was it breach of contract? Is it violation of some equitable duty to the remaining shareholders of the corporation?
I don't think we can honestly claim that, Your Honor. I think what we're looking at is what was the impact, what should have been received by my people if he had given us that one extra day of the week. If he'd have been accountable for a fourth day instead of just the three, that was the amount we were asking that he'd be required to pay back, along with the $30,000 that Judge D'Astero found was due because of the misapplication of the Medicaid monies, then, you know, we think that would be reasonable. We don't mind giving him his reasonable share of the value of the hard assets.
What's your bottom line? Where was the judge off here? By how much?
Well, we believe the judge should have given us basically two-thirds of the value of that fourth day of the week that wasn't being put in.
And how much is that?
I think that was about $177,000. I think the total claim that we believe we're entitled to is $177,000, including the $30,000 for Medicaid, including $200,000 for that fourth day of the week, and then offsetting for the $76,000 in hard assets.
Is that for the 13-year period?
I'm sorry, sir.
Are you asking that for the 13-year period?
No, sir. No, just for the last four years. We understand we can't go back that far, although we think it's a continuing violation of his fiduciary duty. But no, we're just looking at the values those last four.
So here's what I'm trying to reconcile. You're saying that by virtue of his conduct, he wasn't really one-third of this entity.
He really wasn't, because he wasn't devoting the time that the other guys were. He was basically, he said, hey, I'm going to cut back because I want to spend all this time on my side deals with Allegiant.
And this is all grounded in fiduciary duty and good faith?
We believe it is, Your Honor. Yes, ma'am.
And that's how you come to pick up on this two-thirds of the fourth day?
Well, the point is, if he had given us...
You're translating, it seems like with respect to the fourth day, you are applying the one-third, one-third, one-third formula.
Yeah, because we say if you value his, that fourth day of the week, and basically by looking at what he's made and then dividing that back in, we don't have a problem with him getting one-third of that money. Because had he devoted 4 days a week instead of three, then the pot would have been bigger, but one-third of that would have been his. So we're just saying that's where we need to get the bulk of the money in this case. We also need to get the money that Judge Zastera had given us for the Medicaid. Because of the impact there was that Medicaid only pays 31% on claims, whereas other insurance sources pay 70 or more percent.
Did your clients waive that?
I don't believe we did, Your Honor. Again, it's a continuing violation, and I think that was the basis for which Judge Zastera said that we were entitled to that $30,000 just for the last 4 years of the time that the fellows were committed.
There was $90,000 that was put into an escrow account. So there's some question about $30,000 of that belonging to Dr. Strohmeyer.
We had no dispute with him being entitled to one-third of that, Your Honor. And that was part of the money in our allocations we show in the brief where we say he's clearly entitled to that. The reason that money
did the judge give him that $30,000?
I believe he gave him that plus more because he was looking at the value of the stock, and our concern was that if you tried to look at the value of the stock, you were getting into so many of these peripheral issues. You know, for instance, goodwill. There's no goodwill left when somebody takes all of his clients, patients, takes one-third of our staff, and leaves us high and dry. There wasn't any goodwill, there wasn't any intangibles left to be divided. And when he puts a bunch of value on these patient records, the real problem there is that patient records mean nothing except as you have the patient. And if you have the patient, then those records apply to somebody. If you don't, then they are more of a burden because you simply have to maintain them and protect them. I hope that's responsive to your questions.
Thank you.
I think I have a few seconds left. I'd like to hit on three reasons why I would ask you to consider the testimony of Dr. Nagel when his testimony conflicts with the experts hired by the other side. First of all, if you consider that Judge Zastera was presented with a conflict between the testimony of Dr. Nagel on one side and Mr. Killian on the other side, he opted to go with the testimony, the more believable testimony, of Dr. Nagel. And when you consider the fact that there's an interweaving of the testimony between Killian and between the CPA and the other expert that was brought in by them, we think all of that testimony becomes rather tainted, and that you need to be looking at the more believable testimony that came from Dr. Nagel. We also think it's important to believe that when Raquel Hartranft, who was the office manager under with PFM for years, and she was working closely day in and day out with Dr. Nagel, she had to testify, even though she went with the other side, she had to testify that he was a straight shooter, he was honest. Now, that was something that was not in her best interest at that time because she'd gone to work for the other side. So
that was number two?
That was number two. The other was that there was one situation where he corrected the testimony of one of their experts who came in and said that the value of disposables was only $18,000. And he came in and he said, no, the figures are wrong. We actually, those disposables were actually worth $31,000, so I owe you more money than you claimed on that area. But I think if you look at those three examples, The testimony of Dr. Nagel is very credible, very believable, and when you look at the concoction that came from the other side, you can conclude that really Dr. Nagel's testimony needs to be believed. I think my time is up, so if you have any more questions, I will have a great day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is State versus Paul J. Jedlicka.